Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, now part of Intelligent Investor, finance presenter on ABC News and a columnist for The New Daily.
Hello, and I'm Effie Zahos, Chief Content Officer and Money Commentator at InvestSmart, and also the Today Show Money Expert.
And we are the Money Cafe. Now, Effie, welcome to the Money Cafe, Effie.
It is.
For the first time.
Yeah, it's a real honour to be on your show. I hear it's a big deal, this thing.
And we're here at Short Store Cafe in beautiful downtown Hawthorne, and we're joined by Nathan from Perth, who is over here to watch the Eagles get beaten on Sunday. No, they won't get beaten. But it's great to see Nathan in the cafe, a listener to the Money Cafe. Welcome to the Money Cafe, Nathan. Now, as you said, you're the money commentator on Today Show on Channel 9, as well as being my colleague at InvestSmart. And you get up at 5 a.m. or 4:30 a.m. every day to go on the Today Show. I think that's pretty incredible. And it must have been cold this morning.
I chose probably the wrong 2 days to come to Melbourne, Alan. It was extremely cold. Especially waiting outside Channel 9 studios there in South Bank for someone to open the actual doors there. You get used to it. You get used to the early morning starts. I like to think of it as you have a couple more hours under your sleeve to kickstart the day.
So what did you talk about this morning?
Today's topic actually was quite surprising. It got my attention. We can stream movies, we can stream, music. You can now stream your wages on a daily basis. So it was this new app that has been developed by Employment Hero, and they're a software HR payroll device for employees. About 300,000 businesses use this to pay their employees. Businesses do, and they've come up with this idea
in Australia or around the world.
I think this in Australia. Australia. Right. And the concept came about, I believe they've worked out that it's about like $30 billion that people earn each day but haven't been paid. And so I guess in a cost of living crisis, money's tight, and they're thinking, well, maybe we should be paid daily rather than monthly or fortnightly. On the top level, it sounds great, but I think once I looked further
getting
into it...
Getting paid daily, dear idea.
It's a little bit scary, Alan. The reason being is once you start working off a daily budget, to me, that screams alarm bells. That means that you don't have that cash flow aside to help you through the bumps and so on. If you're needing cash each day to top up and you're relying on the income you're earning at that moment, so basically live streaming it into your bank account, there's probably a bigger issue there. There are lots of these providers out there, not daily streaming, but there's lots of earned wages platforms, so you can only access, usually they have some limits up to 50% of what you've earned, but others give you a pay advance, and that's a little bit concerning.
I think it should be hourly. What do you reckon?
Hourly?
Get paid by the hour into your bank account.
Let me just check my account now, Alan. I'll see how much I've made. I've been up since 5. I wonder if that counts.
That's interesting. So do you know if anyone is taking the daily wage now?
Oh, yeah, they've got a few streamers. Yeah, absolutely.
A few streamers.
Yeah, they've got a few there, definitely. Fantastic. Yeah, but I think it's the thing to watch out here is that there are fees attached to these, and there is, jokes aside, whilst this sounds interesting, the bigger issue here is the budgeting for households, and I've seen that come under extreme pressure over the past 4 years. I guess I understand people who are paid monthly may like the concept. And also, let's not forget we've got super that in 2026 will be paid, has to be paid. The employers have to pay it every time they pay their employees.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So there could be some incentive there for some bosses to think, there's a lot of hassle paying super each time, each fortnight or each week, if that's how they pay it. They may want to extend that monthly. I wouldn't be surprised if some employers think, I'm going to start paying my employees monthly because it's going to be a lot easier with the super.
Yeah, fair enough. So what are your golden rules? I mean, this is a great opportunity for our listeners on Money Cafe to, tap into your brain on money issues.
Yeah,
because you're such an authority on it. So what are your golden rules for dealing with money?
Yeah, look, I would say there'd be pretty much what your listeners will probably adhere to. I mean, they're oldies, they're goodies, they're time-tested. For me, it's always understanding what you're investing in. you've got to understand what you're invested in, or even what you're buying on both sides of the fence. I like to keep things simple. What I've seen over the past 4 years is an extreme interest in personal finance. I think my background basically started out from, you know, banking, did a Bachelor of Economics, and then moved into, you know, magazine world with Paul Clitheroe, who's also the chair of InvestSmart. And a lot of the messages said back then still stand the test of time now. You know, there's no magic to creating wealth as I've seen it. It's save little, it's save often, it's understand what you're investing in and automate it. And there are a lot of the strategies that people are taking right now.
Automate your saving, you mean?
Automate your savings, automate your investings. I mean, there's one thing that we actually do good, and that is, you know, we never miss a Netflix subscription. We never miss a bill payment because we automate those. You think about how you set up all your accounts, it's all automated. The same concept should be applied when it comes to our savings and investments.
That's good advice, I think. And do you have any money hacks?
I have any money hacks? Absolutely.
That you can tell us?
Look, there are so many on a micro level for households, and I've seen a lot of people having to do this. I mean, the last 4 years, again, I keep going back to the last 4 years because it's really taken a pandemic for a lot of people to have a good look at where their money is going. And for a lot of us, we haven't had the luxury of even being able to, you know, invest over this period because it's really just staying afloat. So the household bills have become the biggest burden. When you look at so many consumer reports, it is cost of living, the groceries, your energy bills, your home loan bills, and so on. I mean, what I've seen a simple thing to do and what I do is basically twice a year, there's nothing exciting about this at all, Alan, I actually go old school. I print out my transaction, and we're in a digital society. Everything in my transaction account's recorded. I actually have two highlighters, keep it simple, two different colours. One is basically fixed costs, highlight that all in one colour. And then the other colour is all your tap and go, your discretionary. And you'll be quite shocked to see just how much tap and go is on that sheet. And then I tackle those colours one by one. So the colours to do with fixed costs, I actually go line by line. What's my mortgage rate at? What am I getting for it? Can I do better? Energy bill, what am I doing? What can I do better? And so on. And I've actually done an analysis whereby when I look at what is the average household bills versus what could be the cheapest or best value, so even just using like comparison sites like Canstar, which I'm ambassador for, I check that out and I see there's a saving already in the first year of $14,000. And that's what you can do on your household bills. And even right now, I'm seeing so much competition. I mean, let's talk energy bills. When's the last time you had a look at your energy bill, your statement, your actual statement?
You mean look at it in terms of can I do better?
Just even look to see what's on it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yesterday, as a matter of fact, but just because I had to pay it.
Oh, because you had to pay. Did you notice there was a little box on that statement that said, hey, Alan, you could actually save X amount over a year if you switch to this plan that we have. You're on an expensive plan with us. That box.
How did you know?
I reckon you didn't see that. I reckon you automatically fade it. So that little box has become law, and that was just that came in towards the end of last year. And a lot of people have not even noticed it on their statements. I mean, I know my parents, I showed them, I go, look, this keeps popping on your statement. Have you done anything about it? So that's a no-brainer. You can switch within your own provider. They're telling you, they're making it so easy. It's on that statement. Hey, you're paying too much, go to that one. A lot of people don't do it. And then they're also like little cash grabs, you know, not going to make you rich.
Why don't they bloody well change it to the cheaper thing anyway? Because how can they assume that? Why would they assume that anyone wants to pay more than they need to? They should just charge you the cheapest amount to begin with. Surely.
Wouldn't that be great if we could go that way with everything, even our home loans? I mean, if you got a home loan with one provider, more than likely, you're probably on a package loan. You're probably paying right around 6-odd%, maybe 7%. They have cheaper basic loans themselves. I guess they just can't assume that this is the product for you. You actually physically have to make that choice. But look, energy's energy, isn't it? I just wanted to flick on my light. So,
well, exactly. Yeah. So how different can the products be?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, geez. Oh, well. What else have you been talking about on today? What about yesterday?
Look, there's been a lot of discussion on interest rates, forecasts.
So what do you think? Do you think we're going to get a rate hike this year?
Well, we had those monthly numbers that came out. They did surprise everyone. Not all everyone. I think Westpac economists predicted that it will land at 4, the monthly figure. And as you know, Alan, I mean, that monthly figure is a little bit volatile. It doesn't include everything in it. I think the RBA minutes that came out even yesterday were pretty clear that they will make a stance if they have to. They will move rates. But I think we've still got a couple of key data to come out to make a decision yet. I don't think we can lock in a rate hike automatically now in August. I think we'll have to wait for retail spending numbers. I think they come out today.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they'll come out today. We'll wait for those job numbers, just see if that's getting any tighter. And then...
Most importantly, the CPI for the quarter on July 31st.
Yeah, and that is the one that they... It will be a live decision. So, yes, the market is factoring in that there would be a rate hike. The major banks are definitely not saying any rate cuts, and they've pushed out when rates will move till next year. But none have yet said a rate hike as well. I think
none
it'll
of the
be
big
a very...
banks have. I just got one this morning from Morgan Stanley predicting a rate hike in August. Quite a few economists are predicting a rate hike in August.
Yeah.
And the market is, I think, about 50% odds of a rate hike. So 50-50.
Well, the inflation's so sticky. And when you look at the numbers, it's still that service inflation that we just can't get down. And you look at those monthly numbers too. It's the little things. The insurance costs have gone up, up about, was it 16% or something like that? You've even got streaming services. They've all gone up. So, you know, your haircuts, all that service inflation is becoming so sticky that... The call for a rate hike in August is very loud. And look, there's going to be winners and losers again on either side of that. I mean, when I look at basically self-funded retirees that don't have a mortgage, that have paid it off, it's actually a really good time. If you've got money in the bank or you're investing, it's been a great year. Our super fund returns, they're starting to roll in at the moment now. And what will be interesting here is I'm looking at maybe a turnaround from industry funds versus retail super funds.
Why?
Well, you look at the success of industry funds last year. They did so well because basically the investments that they're in, the unlisted assets, so the infrastructure. And right now they've been valued at a lot lower, and that's changed their asset values. And I'm actually... I reckon we'll start seeing a few retail funds outperforming industry funds this end of financial year results when they start rolling out. And some of them will come out this weekend. Yeah, because of the valuation. So look, for those who don't have a mortgage, we've got the DMI rates that are still low, you know, 0.25% on that first, what is it, 60,000. And you can pick up an account at 5.75 being the highest. There are some good times for those people that don't have mortgage rates. Unfortunately, for the third of us that do have mortgage rates and high inflation, it's August, results is probably we don't want to see a hike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you think that would do to house prices?
Gee, house prices have had a great run, haven't they, Alan? Like, despite the fact that we've had so many rate hikes, despite the fact that, you know, the deposit required now, say, to buy a property in Sydney is like $200,000 if you want to avoid lender's mortgage insurance. I know data that came out from CoreLogic not long ago showed that overall you would have had like a 60,000 equity boost in 1 year. That's looking at dwelling prices, homes and units. I mean, if you look at, say, somewhere like Perth, you're looking at a windfall of $152,000 in 1 year.
Perth's gone mad. 23.6% increase in Perth over 12 months. Amazing.
I mean, you'd be able to answer this more than I would. A strong economy, immigration, going interstate and overseas. Are we all flocking to Perth? What's pushing that up?
Oh, Perth. Well, look, it's just a long way back. I mean, they had a long period of prices underperforming, being lower than everyone else's. So look, there's just a bit of a catch-up going on in Perth.
Yeah, but still a lot of, you look at the numbers of people going to Perth, numbers have jumped there. Everyone seems to, everyone either seems to want to live in Perth or Brisbane.
Well, it's true that, I mean, people are, think of naturally looking for cheaper housing. Yeah. Out of Sydney in particular, but also Melbourne and Brisbane, you know, looking for cheaper places to live. But, you know, like Hobart used to be that place, but Hobart prices over the past 12 months have gone down.
They've gone slightly down, actually, that was the only one out of all the house prices that, it's a nominal amount, $2,000, that they had the medium value of house prices going down. Units held up a little bit better. And that's, I guess, of course, because of affordability. Units have seen a great run over the past 12 months because people can't jump into houses, they're going to the next thing, and that's pushing up prices. But going back to your question, what will happen with property prices, a lot of people are still jumping into the market, because I speak to a lot of brokers, jumping into the market with the expectation that, okay, rates are at their peak now, so I am going to jump in before they go down, and then they continue to push up. So there's a lot of that fear of missing out that's still happening in the property market.
No, I think that's true. Yes, well, all right. Okay, well, I think we need to move on to questions. Before we do, let's have a word, quick word from our sponsor.
Are you passionate about investing or just starting your journey in the world of finance? Tune into StockTake, the podcast from the Intelligent Investor Analyst team that's your gateway to value investing and deep dives into ASX and globally listed securities. Join Intelligent Investors Analysts as they bring the world of investing to life with engaging insights, entertaining stories, and their take on the latest market movements. Subscribe to StockTake today on your favorite podcast platform or head to intelligentinvestor.com.au/podcasts to hear expert knowledge and perspectives that can help you make smarter investment decisions.
First question is from Peter. He says, could you explain currency risk and what hedging looks like to the self-guided investor? Companies such as Carbon Revolution and Illumina are being relisted in the US or taken over by a US company, meaning local investors have to follow their investments to new markets. Most active investors need to have a high level understanding of the risks involved in investing in the US and currencies and how this can work for you or against you. So do you have a view about currency risk for investors?
It's definitely a risk, which is why I like to keep things simple, and I just have a ETF. If I'm international portfolio, it's definitely hedged, protected. And the beauty, I guess, you know, as you pointed out, I work for InvestSmart. There's a great little nifty tool that we have there that is the ETF selector. So you can basically type in the geographical area you want to invest in, international stocks, do you want, you know, currency protection hedged or unhedged, and up will pop up all the ETFs there that you can invest in. And then you can even rank them by star ratings. You know, do you want a 5-star? And it narrows down even further. But yeah, there's definitely risk.
There's definitely, another way to put it, it seems to me, is not just risk, but it's also a bet. So when you, if you bought a foreign stock, whether it's an Australian company that's relocated or you decided to invest in Tesla or something, you're making two bets at once. You're betting on Tesla and you're betting on the currency.
Yeah.
And so you just need to understand those two bets that you're making. And as you say, you need to understand what you're doing. And if you don't want to bet on the currency, there are ways to get away, to hedge that, as the person says. But it's quite difficult for it's hard for an individual investor, a small individual investor, to hedge currency risk. I think it's quite...
Oh, absolutely. I think it's hard. And it's constantly changing too when you look at even what's happening in the US with the election. I mean, if Trump does get in, then, which either party, the implication for our dollar as well, and that would have implications further.
But
and that's
who knows?
A lot for the average Aussie to manage. And you don't have to. That's the beauty about some of these products. You don't have to.
Well, you don't have to. That's right. By buying an Australian ETF that invests in the US, you're buying in Australian dollars, so there's no currency. But if you, as I say, if you decided to invest in a US stock, I don't think it's stupid to do that, to take currency risk as well as the stock risk. It's just a matter of understanding what you're doing.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Xander has asked, my wife has taken 2 of the last 3.5 years off work to raise our kids while I've done my best to progress my career to ensure our financial stability. Now, as a nurse, my wife declined promotions as they would demand more time commitments and her availability. Basically, she'd be prioritising over time spent raising our children. So we are driving the gender pay gap. And in my previous role, I was eligible for 2 weeks unpaid leave as a father, and now I'm in government and I could access parental leave as a father. I've been in a government, I would have been in government sooner with parental leave for fathers. My wife could have taken out the promotion. So what are your thoughts for more substantial parental leave for fathers to give the gender pay gap a nudge? And he's got here, thanks for putting out such a great show every week for many years now. That's nice.
You're welcome, Xander. I reckon that's not stupid, is it? What do you reckon?
Well, we know paid parental leave is going up anyway. I know he's going on a different tangent there. I think I would like to see basically no need to have to do this in the first place. I'd like to see equality in pay for the same job, whatever you know sex you are, and I guess putting more of a nudge or payment on fathers who take parental leave, we shouldn't have to. I guess what I'm trying to say, you shouldn't have to favour it that way. I think there are other ways to fix the problem
from the
beginning.
Yeah. But the point he's trying to make is that women often decline promotions.
Yeah.
And often put themselves back.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say then is then maybe workplaces should be a little bit more flexible so we don't have to decline promotions in the sense that a lot of times that promotions can't be taken is because the work hours may be inflexible, you can't work for home, and it's just not as accommodating.
Yeah, well, but that's just the reality of difficult jobs, isn't it, I suppose?
It is, but we've seen a lot of change in workplaces over the past 4 years because of the pandemic, and I think we've proven a little bit too that, you know, roles can be a lot more flexible. Shared roles, job sharing, same role, two people. Yeah, I guess I'd like to kind of fix the problem at the source rather than the other end.
Fair enough, that's good answer. Okay, Brendan says, why have the odds of a rate hike increased following the May inflation date data? It's widely known that the quarterly CPI data is much more comprehensive than the monthly one, and the monthly outcomes often don't match the quarterly figures. Alan, do you think the quarterly CPI will be lower than expected? I do. And then he goes on to quote Peter Monckton from Bank of Queensland, chief economist there. Look, I reckon you're right. I do think the quarterly CPI will be lower than expected. I don't think there'll be a rate hike in August. I, in fact, do not think there'll be a rate hike this year. And I don't think there'll be a rate cut. And I think what we'll be doing is, at the end of 2025, the cash rate will be what it is now.
No change. The cash rate will be where it is
for another 18 months.
Another 18 months.
That's my opinion.
I agree with you, probably with the quarterly CPI coming out a bit lower. And it's interesting, Shane Oliver wrote about that the other day in his papers, that, hey, don't be surprised if the quarterly CPI comes in lower, because they've known to be, you know, interchangeable in that sense. One goes up, the other one does the opposite. And I guess it really does. For me, I won't make a call. I think you're very brave, which is great. For me, I'd be waiting to see what that month that quarterly CPI comes out with, and then I'd make a call. If it's gone way higher, then absolutely, I would see an August hike. If not, then no.
So you're like the RBA, you're data dependent, are you?
I'm data dependent. Yes, I am.
And I'm foolish, making long-term predictions. I'm absolutely stupid.
You're the previous RBA.
I'll tell you what, there's nothing more certain than if you make a long-term prediction like I just did, you'll be wrong.
Yeah. May not. It's not silly what you're saying. Absolutely not. That's the beauty about forecasts. You can go.
Well, I think we do sometimes forget that the cash rate does sometimes go for 2 or 3 years without changing.
Yeah. Yes.
And has done in the past.
And I think we forget that the cash rate for home loans has averaged, sorry, the rate for home loans, not the cash rate, the actual interest rate for mortgages, in the long run sits around that 6% mark.
And where it is now, the cash rate is roughly on average. I think it's probably, I mean, the argument that takes place within the Reserve Bank is, what is the neutral rate of interest? The neutral rate of interest is the rate at which the economy does not get stimulated or contracts.
Mm-hmm.
it's basically it's what it sounds like. It's neutral, right?
Yeah.
And they kind of constantly argue about what that number is.
Yeah.
And is it above? Because if it's higher than it's if the neutral rate is higher than it currently is,
yeah,
the cash
yeah.
rate is now, then the rate will go up.
Yeah.
And so on. So it seems to me that the neutral rate is probably roughly what it is.
Around there. Yeah, I think with service inflation still being so sticky and we are still spending, but are we using our reserves, our cash reserves to continue spending? It may need a bit of a tweak. I'm going to go on the cautious side and say I reckon it may need a bit more a tweak.
So Joanna's question is right up your alley, so off you go.
Okay, what? I'm a huge fan of Ellen Kohler. Is that
exactly? No,
Joanna,
I didn't mean that.
You got that right, Joanna. So Joanna writes in and says, I have watched quite a few videos where Warren Buffett told people to invest in the S&P 500 index funds. I want to buy ETFs in Australia which are linked to S&P 500 index. Which ETFs are safe and which will probably last for another 100 years? And are we subject to foreign exchange risk if we buy ETFs in Australia linked to the S&P 500 index? So we kind of answered a little bit of that
we did.
In the other
if you buy the if you buy the S&P 500 ETF in Australia, the Australian yeah. ETF for the S&P 500, you won't be taking currency risk.
Spot on. And Joanna, like I said before, I mean, I work for InvestSmart. There are other places that you can jump in as well to be looking at ETFs. But the beauty about, you know, jumping into a ready-made portfolio ETF is that you can have a basket linked to international stocks and it has quite a few in there, quite easy to actually jump in and buy. And look, I'm a big fan of exchange-traded funds myself personally. Low-cost diversification, and I don't have to sit back and, you know, manually adjust my portfolio all the time.
Well, this is a bit of an out there question. Lachlan says, you explained that high-speed or underground networks are too expensive, not competitive. I want to agree with you, but need help reconciling with the reality that in Australia we build gargantuan tunnels for roads but can't do small tunnels for trains. We find land and dollars to build more airports close to the cities but can't for narrow fast rail corridors. Have some of the busiest, most expensive air routes globally. We'll commute to and from airports to arrive early, go to through security in time for a delayed flight, but you can't stretch your legs on. Do we suck at trains? What am I missing here? Are we seats in the chairman's lounge too comfy to fix it? Yes, we suck at trains in Australia. We definitely suck at trains. I mean, if you just go to Europe, get on a train.
Such a difference.
I mean, it's such a difference.
Such a difference. What are we doing wrong here?
Well, so one of the problems is yeah. that we've been talking about fast trains
yes.
for 40 years, yeah. right? But the fast trains we talk about are always a fast train from Melbourne to Sydney and Sydney to Brisbane.
Yeah.
And that will never work because because people prefer to fly. And the cost of flying isn't that dear. So the fast train from Melbourne to Sydney is never going to get off the ground. So what they do is they put it up as a proposal, let's have a look at this, then they find that it's not going to work and they give it away. But what they don't do is have trains to regional yeah. areas that are really good, fast, comfortable trains that'll get you from, I don't know, Orange to Sydney or Toowoomba yeah. to Brisbane and so on.
You'd think with the way geographically we are changing as a society as well, more people going into regional areas, affordability pushing younger people out into regions, you'd think that would be a priority. And it's not just moving people, it's moving goods as well.
Sure,
distribution.
That's right.
And all that can lower the costs of goods to get from A to B. So it always gets me that, you know, you're right, I keep hearing these fast trains is always on the eastern border. And yet we are changing as societies where we are locating ourselves and nothing's happening.
I don't, that's right. So I don't really understand why we suck at trains. I mean, even our trains in the cities aren't that great, really, are they? Not that I've caught one for a while,
yeah.
to be honest. India says, hey, team, I've got a question in regard to housing in Australia. After reading and researching Jeff Speck, never heard of him, and his Walkable Cities book, TED Talk. There you go. What are your thoughts on this theory of changing the face and structure of Australian major cities combined with designing more effective minor regional cities to help solve the housing crisis, the growth of obesity and health issues associated with car-centric cities and potentially greener, cleaner communities? Hugely loaded question. Absolutely, India. And it's a huge take to attempt, I know, but I would love to hear your opinions on whether it will work in the Australian context. It's a bit hard to boil down what the actual proposal is. I think what's going on in Australian major cities is more high-rise. That's what's taking place to get more housing built. I don't know whether that's in line with India's nirvana or not.
Is she basically wanting your thoughts on having these minor regional cities, really setting up micro cities around, so not just focusing?
Yeah. Look, so what I this kind of came up last week or the week before on the Money Cafe, and I expressed the view that the problem in Australia is that whereas other countries have lots of regional cities, like America has cities all over the place, likewise as Europe, Australia doesn't, largely because we haven't got enough water. So whereas most of the inland cities in America and Europe are on rivers, we haven't got many rivers, and they're tiny bloody rivers. So that, you know, so we've got Albury Wodonga, which is on the Murray River, which is a bit of a city. Mildura is on the Murray too. I think Wagga Wagga's on the Murrumbidgee. We just haven't got enough inland rivers that are big enough and strong enough to support big cities. So I'm not sure that it will ever actually work.
I don't know about big cities, but definitely from a a buying point of view and who's moving out to regional areas, I'm seeing numbers, a lot of young people, as I said before, going out to regional areas to live because of affordability. And obviously, if work allows too, you know, how flexible.
Well, that's right. You've got to have jobs.
And often they are still in a situation where you've got this urban sprawl that it's not that far away that they can still come back into a major city, even if it's a 2 or 3 hour drive. So we're definitely not
sprawling
out further.
As discussed, we haven't got good enough trains.
Yeah. We did say that, didn't we?
Yes. Okay, you can do the next.
Bobby says, I have been very much impacted by 13 straight rate rises. I think a lot of the focus goes on the increased monthly payments, but the extra interest payments get overlooked. I know the minimum payments are recalculated to take this into effect. However, I'm sure there are many like me who see those huge interest charges each month and try to pay off the mortgage and try to pay off extra off the mortgage each month to pay down the principal. So I think surely that is accelerating the impact on the economy. In the meanwhile, so many small businesses here in Hobart are doing it tough because it's like, I'm sorry, I can't spend my money with you because all my savings are going to the bank.
Well, that's right. I once calculated how much over the past 10 years, how much more from people's savings or people's actual spending is going to banks as opposed to small businesses. And the answer was, this is across Australia, it was... It was something like $4 billion per month.
In payments are going...
Extra money.
Because of the mortgage hikes.
Banks because of the increase in house prices.
Oh, because of the increase in house prices,
Because mortgages have grown so much that if you take a long-term view of it, that's meant that more and more money is going to banks instead of other kind of spending. People... people are now devoting more and more, a larger and larger proportion of their income to paying off the mortgage. Whereas in the past they were, spending it elsewhere.
Yeah. And I mean, imagine being a small business then. I mean, obviously I'm not in a small business, but a small business that has a mortgage as well. So your income's dropped and yet your own personal expenses have gone up because of the mortgage repayments. How far then do you think the stage three tax cuts, which are in effect right now, so, you know, technically we've all had a pay rise, would you expect a lot of that to be mopped up in mortgage payments still, or people putting a buffer in, or do you think some businesses will see some relief?
Oh, look, I think everyone will get a bit of relief about it and probably a bit of an increase in spending, but I think it's peanuts, really.
Yeah. Not inflationary enough to go towards your rate hike.
That's right. Not inflationary enough. That's it. That's the problem with the tax cuts.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
They're obviously calibrated to not be inflationary, which is a good idea, I think.
Yeah.
Which means that they're not that big, you know.
Yeah.
There's not that much money. So, look, I think a lot of people, and the good news is that everyone gets a tax cut. That's great. But I don't think it's going to change the world.
No, I agree. I think the important thing is we don't, for those of us who don't have mortgages and that, the tax cut, don't lose it to a lifestyle creep. Because I tell you what, $36
a week. What did you call that, a lifestyle creep?
A lifestyle creep. Come on, we've all been there. You get paid more somehow and you just disappears because you want more or your expectations go higher. Think of all the pay rises you've had in a year. Where have they gone?
Lifestyle creep.
Yeah, lifestyle creep. That's it.
I like it. Well, thanks everyone for listening to today's episode of The Money Cafe with Effie Zahos, who is the head of content at InvestSmart and the money commentator on Today Show on Channel 9 every day. And what else?
A few hats. Sit on the board of Extra, a not-for-profit organisation for financial literacy. And we have that Talk Money program through schools, which is great. About 200,000 students have gone there through that, which is free for schools. Yeah, I think that's an... Oh, and a Canstar ambassador. I forgot about that one too.
No, there you are.
There you go.
Okay. I'll be back next week with Stephen Mayne. So send in a question and Stephen and I will answer it. And if you email it at to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Till then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report.
And I'm Effie Zarkos from InvestSmart. Thanks, Alan, for having me on your show.